Thank you, Justice Rehnquist. We'll hear arguments first this morning in Exxon Corporation against Egerton and the consolidated case. Mr. Crow, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This piece of legislation passed in Alabama in 1979 involves several constitutional questions which have been raised by producers or sellers of natural gas and crude oil within the state. It was introduced in 1979 by Representative Hines of Escambia County, one of the state's largest producing counties insofar as oil and gas production is concerned. It initially was introduced to increase the tax 2% statewide. Representative Hines, according to the record, had failed to pass this legislation in three previous occasions.
Is he unable to pass legislation all by himself, or does the legislature pass it?
He can pass legislation under local courtesy if it affects only his county, he being the only representative from the county, from that district in the state of Alabama.
Is the bill actually enacted, at least informed by the whole legislature?
Yes. When he encountered the difficulty with the Speaker of the House, by his own testimony, in the governor's office, in the House Ways and Means Committee, he submitted a very important amendment we submit as a matter of legislative history. The tax was 4%. It was increased to 2%. At the foot of the taxing paragraph, he entered a so-called depth proviso, which provided in effect that provided, however, that the increase shall be limited to wells producing in a Smackover formation at the depth of 15-15-8. His county was, according to the record, the only county in the state, then and now, producing hydrocarbons in this geological interval at this depth. He represented to the committees and on the floor that his amendment had made the bill local, applied to his own county. He was quoted in the newspapers as having said this. And the bill passed with no nays, essentially. Accordingly, the bill received local courtesy. The chairman of the Ways and Means Committee so testified. The legislative journal entries show that the bill was carried on the journal as an uncontested local bill.
Counsel, I'm a little uncertain why, if the enactment passed the legislature, what difference does it make how it got there?
It makes a difference in this respect. Our clients are non-Escambia County producers, which were not expected to have been taxed under the legislation. Once the bill had been passed, the Commissioner of Revenue, the appellee here, construed it legally to be a statewide measure. Refund suits were filed by the producers, the non-Escambia County producers. Uncontested legislative history in the form of journal entries, physical notes limiting the revenues only to Escambia County. There was no contrary legislative history. The Circuit Court of Montgomery County ruled that the act under the legislative history was clearly and without any question a local act applying to only one county out of 67.
What federal claim do you make out of all these facts? I mean, doesn't the Supreme Court of Alabama have the final say as to what
I realize that this court does not, Justice Rehnquist, involved generally in statutory construction of state statutes. But when the Supreme Court of Alabama ruled that they were, would not look at the legislative history, we contend we were not given a fair hearing on, as a matter of due process, when they totally ignored the uncontroverted legislative history, including statements from the sole sponsor of the local bill.
But aren't we bound by what the Alabama Supreme Court rules?
I think we cite in our brief two cases that indicate, one is a Missouri case, the Brinkerhoff case, where this court held that actions of the Missouri Supreme Court deprived the litigants there of due process.
The Alabama Supreme Court, I take it, heard your arguments on legislative history. They just didn't highlight the legislative
history. They said they could not stray into the mazes of conjecture.
Well, there are lots of opinions from this court that say the same thing, aren't they?
Under circumstances, however, where there is uncontroverted testimony from the sponsor himself, the sole and only sponsor, that it was his intention to tax his own county to address a revenue shortfall in his own county.
Well, I speak only for myself, but I hope you have a better federal claim than that one.
Mr. Crow, on a slightly different subject, as I understand it, the commissioner now takes the position that the act in question does not prohibit producers, working producers, from passing through the increase in severance taxes just so long as they don't do it as taxes. Now, if that position is correct, how have your clients suffered any injury?
Well, during the currency of this act, they were prohibited from passing through the severance tax.
As taxes.
As a tax.
And so I'm curious how you establish your injury if the commissioner's present position is correct.
All right. Justice O'Connor, the contract fixed a price. They fix a definite price. The National Gas Policy Act for various categories of natural gas fixed a price. And either by virtue of the maximum statutory ceiling price and or by virtue of the contract provisions themselves, we could only charge the price either permitted by law or agreed to by contract, but were permitted to pass on taxes under the express wording of the contracts.
Do we have the proof in front of us that would clearly establish that your clients could not have increased the price to take care of
the
this
contracts
tax.
Are in the record. And, of course, the law is that...
And they allow escalation of prices.
The contracts?
Uh-huh.
I'm not certain whether the price escalation was not involved here. I'm not sure whether they... some of them may have and some of them may... have not.
Well, in other words, we don't really know whether your client suffered any injury. Would we have to remand to determine that?
I think you do know, Justice O'Connor, that the clients who could not pass through the severance taxes as agreed upon and had to swallow that tax suffered the loss of the amount of tax that they could not pass through.
But we don't know, if I may pursue it further, whether they could have passed it on in some other form.
I think that they could not have because the NGPA mandates the maximum price in both intra and interstate commerce, and the contracts, some of which predated the NGPA, specified what that price would be. Turning for a moment to the equal protection arguments that we have advanced to the court with respect to the royalty owner exemption, the act in question exempted the royalty owners from the 2% increase, but apparently left the royalty owners subject to the 4% portion of the tax. The record shows that we had both leases as well as the contracts to which Justice O'Connor referred, which specifically provided in the case of the leases that the lessee and the lessor would share and bear the severance tax pro rata. So we are contending that we have that the royalty owner exemption should be held unconstitutional. The class we submit to the court is one of ownership. There is a mineral fee, if the court will, a producing mineral estate. The royalty owner owns a share in it as a joint tenant. The lessee owns a share in it as a joint tenant. This court has held in Barwise versus Shepherd that an oil and gas lease constitutes nothing more or less than a common or joint adventure, with the profits to be shared pro rata in accordance with the terms and provisions of the lease. Thus, we submit that a lessor is a royalty owner, and the lessee is a landowner, and the lessee is likewise a landowner under the jurisprudence of Alabama and most oil-producing states. There are three reasons for this. The Alabama Code specifically provides that the tax will be levied in proportion to ownership. The Alabama Code specifically provides that producers shall include a royalty owner. The Alabama Code specifically says that the tax is levied on the full stream of the well, including that known as the royalty owner. Furthermore, the code provides, and this is not in any of the briefs, and it perhaps should have been, the code provides that the severance tax is in lieu of ad valorem taxes, and ad valorem taxes, of course, being a tax on real estate. And we say that the only reasonable, logical, fair classification is that of ownership of the production from the mineral fee, and that there is no reasonable classification that can be where it says 4% of the tax will be borne equally, but 2% will be borne unequally and disproportionate to the ownership. We submit to the court that there is another reason that makes the tax regressive. Royalty percentage is very widening. This record shows some royalties up to over 50%.
What's constitutionally infirm about a regressive tax?
Well, I think that it's a question of classification and equal protection within the class.
Well, I suppose I agree with you, but you said you're arguing now that the tax is regressive, and a regressive tax isn't an unconstitutional tax.
It doesn't apply equally, even between lessees.
Well, no taxes apply equally. Some people are taxed and some aren't.
Well, what I'm saying, I think, is, Justice Rehnquist, that the tax does not apply equally between either royalty owners or working interest owners or landowners, and that the landowner or the is should be the criteria of making a distinction between one molecule of gas and another molecule of gas. That the royalties gas should be the same share of production as the working interest. In fact, the largest royalty owner in Mobile County is one of the major oil companies. One of the major paper companies is probably owning a lot of land is probably second. So there's no societal distinction between the royalty interest side and the working interest side. It simply is that some people prefer to invest on the royalty side and others invest on the working interest side. In the Barwise case, which I previously referred to, it was a Texas tax involved, which was equally imposed on the full production of the well, both on the lessor and the lessee. And this court held that it was a reasonable classification as to both the lessor as it was to the lessee. And our authority for proposition we are submitting to the court is the 1937 decision of this court in Ballwise versus Shepherd.
Mr. Arundel.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Before Act 434 was adopted by the legislature of Alabama, the state had a very simple and understandable tax scheme for the severance taxation of oil and gas production. The tax was imposed on all of the oil and gas produced. There was a definition of who were the producers of that gas, or oil. It included both the royalty owner and the working interest owner, each of whom bore the ultimate incidence of the tax in accordance with his or its ratable ownership of oil or gas produced. When Act 434 was passed, however, we find a drastic change in the Alabama scheme. Because the legislature comes along, and for the first time, with respect to the 2% increase that was provided by that statute, exempts the royalty owner, the royalty owner's share of production, from any portion of the tax increase. The language of the statute was, any person who is a royalty owner shall be exempt from the payment of any increase in taxes herein levied, and shall not be liable therefore. To make doubly clear the intent of the legislature, they then proceeded with what is called in the briefing in this case the pass-through prohibition, in which they say, the privilege tax herein levied shall be absorbed and paid by those persons engaged in the business of producing or severing oil or gas only, and the producer shall not pass on the cost of such tax payments, either directly or indirectly, to the consumer. It being the express intent of this act that the tax herein levied shall be borne exclusively by the producer or severer of oil or gas.
That means the working interest, I think.
Normally. As construed by the state, that is what it means. Yes. But that construction, if Your Honor please, comes in the background of a statutory scheme where the statutory definition of producers, unchanged by Act 434, covers both the royalty owner and the working interest owner. And so, in effect...
But the 2% specifically excluded the royalty owner, amendment.
It depends, if the Court please, on whether they have, by implication, repealed the definition of producer, which we do not think that they have, because, among other things, the statute continues to say that the tax shall be imposed on all of the production, including the share of the royalty owner. Now, this comes in a posture where, as the evidence showed, my clients, for example, had leases where the landowner would expressly agree to pay his proportionate share of severance taxes. We had gas sales contracts where the purchaser would expressly agree to pay any increase in severance taxes. And because of the existence of those contracts, our first contention is that there has been an unconstitutional impairment of contracts. Our second contention is that there has been a denial of equal protection of the law. Now,
Do you have a position on the question of the position now taken by the commissioner that the tax, in effect, could be passed on if you call it something else and just raise the price?
Yes, I do, Justice O'Connor, and I recall your question, Mr. Crow, on that subject. As we endeavored to point out in our reply brief, the commission is engaged in an absolutely impermissible attempt to rewrite the clear language of the statute. When you say, and as the language that I just said does say, that the tax has got to be absorbed by the producer and that he can't pass it on to anybody else, how can the commissioner say to the contrary?
Do you think the Alabama Supreme Court opinion was equivocal on that point?
I do not understand the language of the
Supreme Court. The language, at least, doesn't make it crystal clear, and I wonder whether that isn't a question for the state law courts.
Well,
rather than a question for us.
I do not understand what the Supreme Court has said. I see what the commissioner has said, and I can read very clearly what counsel for the commissioner said at an earlier date. If your Honor will look at page 40 of the joint appendix, you will find a quotation from Exhibit 19, Plaintiff's Exhibit 19, in which counsel for the commissioner construed the act and expressly said that it prohibited any pass-through to anybody.
Mr. Arundel, you mentioned two questions that you saw in this case. Unless I have this case confused with some other case on the calendar, I had been under the impression that at least one question was whether this area, this Alabama statute, had been preempted by federal law.
Well, that is certainly an additional.
I haven't heard the word preemption from anyone
that's
yet.
That's certainly an additional question, if Your Honor please. And it's one, of course, that we addressed in our brief that the government, as amici, has addressed. We do say that it has been preempted. And it's interesting in this regard and in connection with Justice O'Connor's question that in the state's initial brief, they urge this complete misreading of the statute, claiming that we could pass through as long as we fraudulently represented that we were doing something else.
Well, are you going to discuss the preemption issue in your argument?
Oh, yes, I expect to, and I'm
well, how else can you win this case except on a federal constitutional ground, such as preemption?
Well, it seems to me that we have three questions. We've got the supremacy question, is the preemption question.
Yes.
We have the impairment of contracts, and we've got the equal protection question. And those are the only grounds that we assert on behalf of my clients.
And did you present all of those to the Alabama Supreme Court?
We presented all of those to Alabama Supreme Court, yes.
On both acts, did you present to the preemption question?
I beg, sir?
Did you present the preemption question on both acts?
No, we did not. We presented the preemption question solely on the NGPA.
Well, then what right do you have to do it on the other act here if you didn't present
it? We haven't, sir. My clients have not. The reason, a reason being, first, that we think that it's clear that the statutory prohibition and its conflict with the NGPA isn't a severable item. The legislature of Alabama never intended to say you can't pass through as to gas, but you can as to oil. So that if it's bad under the NGPA, it's bad, and it gets stricken. And we think that's the easy, clear argument. In the second place, two of my clients are engaged in the Tully litigation. It is their belief that the EPA issues are properly addressed in the federal courts through the federal court system to TECA. If we were asked to express an opinion and this court asked to pass on an EPAA thing, we certainly agree with the position taken by amici in its brief on that question. But we did not argue that in our brief. What this act has done is not only, you see, to tax the producer, the working interest owner, on his own share of production, but has required that he pick up the tax and pay it on the royalty owner's interest share of production. Completely contrary to the definition of who shall be producers, completely contrary, we believe, to this court's opinion in Barwise v. Shepherd. Now, It's interesting to see that when the state addresses the impairment question here, he makes no effort to try to meet the kind of test that the court has laid down in Blaisdell and his progeny, insofar as the circumstances under which contracts may be impaired. All he does in substance is to say that the legislature probably was trying to avoid being perceived as levying a consumer tax. Well, now that may be a good political reason for a member of the legislature, but it certainly, in our judgment, does not express the kind of broad public general societal purpose that is required if you're going to have a constitutional impairment. And in this instance, our reasonable contractual expectations were certainly destroyed. Even, Justice O'Connor, if the state were correct in rewriting the statute as they attempt to do now, how do they take the part? What about the royalty owner? What do they say about that? Do they say that the royalty owner has to pay its tax? Do they rewrite that too?
Are your clients royalty owners?
Our clients are lessees and also royalty owners. We have both working interest and royalty owners, and our royalty owners. So we can see, we submit that as far as the impairment question is concerned, that's a complete absence on part of the state to really address the test of Blaisdell and his progeny. When you get to the equal protection aspects of the matter, in addition to the statutory definition, look, if the court will, at the impact of what this does. If you've got a royalty owner, if you've got a lease, excuse me, sir.
Please, the preemption point.
Preemption? On preemption, the NGPA, and that is the only argument that we make in our brief, and I will address that only rather than the EPA question. The NGPA clearly says that to the maximum lawful price may be added severance taxes imposed by the states. Flat language of the statute says that. I submit to Your Honor, there is no way to read this statute, this pass-through prohibition in this statute, without saying that the legislature of Alabama has directly sought to nullify that provision in GPA. It's a clear and direct conflict.
But returning to Justice O'Connor's question of a while ago, if the commissioner, the state commissioner, is correct that the law does not permit pass-throughs, as long as you don't say you're passing through the tax in so many words, do you think there's a necessary conflict with the federal law?
Well, may I just go back again, if I may, to that page 40 on the joint appendix.
I know that. I just said if he is correct. Now, let's just suppose, just suppose that the Supreme Court of Alabama had expressly said this law does not forbid pass-throughs as long as you don't call what you're passing through a tax expressly. Now, suppose the Alabama Supreme Court had said that. Would you be here then?
I think we would. I think if Your Honor please, we would still.
You would still be making your equal protection contract clause arguments?
Yes.
You wouldn't be making your preemption arguments, would you?
What? If Your Honor please get the preemption question, which I think is the first one that Your Honor put to me. As I think, yes, we would have a conflict with NGPA.
Because they say you may pass through the tax.
The tax, right. You may, and they don't say, for example, they set a maximum lawful price based on the factors of escalation and so on. And they don't say we can up that any 2%, and then having done that, just say we've had a price increase, so we've met the Alabama statute as currently interpreted by the commissioner. Yes, I think we would clearly continue to have the preemption problem in the case. As to whether we would continue to have any impairment or equal protection, I think Your Honor is sort of asking me to to just to say that we're going to violate the law.
Just say yes. You would still be here on the other two questions.
Right. I would be here on the other two questions.
Thank you.
And we would indeed still, even the commissioner's argument, of course, doesn't get to the royalty owner exemption. Even if he can rewrite the clear language of the statute like he claims to, there's no way for him to say that we had any right to go and deduct from the royalty payments to the royalty owners. They tax on his proportionate share of the production.
Counsel, are you making claim for the taxes that you did not pass through before this latest interpretation by the Alabama court?
We have not. We are making a claim for the 2% that we have paid to the state under what we consider to be a non-severable unconstitutional statute.
This is money you've already paid out.
We paid the money to the state. It's being held in escrow pending the resolution of the case.
Are you saying that if the current interpretation is correct, you still have claim for back taxes that you shouldn't have had to pay?
I'm sorry, I did not understand, Your Honor.
Well, if you accept the new interpretation by the commissioner that the tax can be passed through if you hide it enough, do you still have a claim, assuming you accept his interpretation, for back taxes, the taxes you could not pass through? I don't understand it.
Yes, I would say that we do, because we have not, in fact, passed through the taxes, you see. We've just paid the money to the state. And if the court were to now say, for example, that we're not going to declare the entire act unconstitutional, we can consider it severable, but we're going to nullify on preemption grounds and on equal protection and on impairment of contract or whatever, these unconstitutional provisions, then presumably we would have some chance of going after the people with whom we had contracts, but only those with whom we had contracts. As, for example, if we sold crude oil on the spot market during the time that this act was in effect, we got no contract to get any more money from those people. We were prohibited by the state from adding the severance tax to the price. We paid the tax on that sale. But we can't go back and say to somebody, say it had been 2% more to you in those days if we'd been able to pass it through. So yes, we would
May
have.
May I ask a question about what you actually put into escrow in the state? You paid the 2% increase. First of all, you had a 4% tax before. I want to say you have an example where you had a 75% working interest and there's a 25% royalty. Under the 4%, you paid 4% of 75% of the production, and under the 2%, you pay 100%.
Right.
So, and you pay the 100% regardless of the size of the working interest. Is that correct? And that
correct.
All that money is in escrow.
Correct.
The whole 2%.
And the 2%, not the 4%, the 2% was paid under protest and is in escrow, awaiting the decision of this court.
Thank you. Mr. Breckinridge, I'm sure it must be apparent to you now that we're somewhat interested in the preemption question, and we want you to be sure to address that.
Mr. Chief
Justice, in your own time.
And may it please the court, I was going to address the arguments that they raised as they raised them, but I, sitting here, determined that this court's highly interested in the preemption clause, and I better get to that first and not delay any longer. It's the position of the Commissioner of Revenue that there is no conflict with the federal statute, and thus there is no preemption issue. The NGPA, the Natural Gas Policy Act, the only federal statute that we're talking about here today, and let me say why I say that. The trial court did not say anything about the EPAA, and neither did the Supreme Court of Alabama. This court has been asked to look at the decision of the Supreme Court of Alabama to see if it's correct or not. There's nothing in the Supreme Court of Alabama's decision whatsoever about the EPAA. So I would like to address my preemption clause, preemption question solely to the Natural Gas Policy Act. Now, what the Natural Gas Policy Act says, the particular section of the Natural Gas Policy Act that's in dispute, what it says is that the first seller of the natural gas is allowed to raise the maximum lawful price to reflect recovery, and it uses the word recovery, of certain items, and they're listed A, B, C, D, and E. And item A is state severance taxes. Item B is cost of transportation, et cetera, et cetera. These are all deemed costs under the NGPA that allows a first seller or producer, a working interest, a producer, first seller, to recover his cost. Now
the language of this Alabama statute says that the producer can't pass on the tax either directly or indirectly.
That's correct.
Well, you're arguing he can do it indirectly, are you not?
What I'm saying is that the Alabama Supreme Court, when faced with this statute, first of all, they have certain rules of statutory construction to give the appellants equal protection and due process that they have to follow. And what the Supreme Court of Alabama said is
that... Do you think the Supreme Court of Alabama really decided that question?
I believe so. Yes, ma'am. And let's go to the language they used. The two acts are aimed at, this is the Supreme Court of Alabama speaking. The two acts are aimed at entirely different.
Do you have a citation to the appendix to the petition?
Yes, yes, Justice Rehnquist. It's page 12 of the joint appendix.
Thank you.
Page 12. The two acts, they're talking about the Alabama Act and the NGPA, are aimed at entirely different purposes. In other words, although, and this is the point I want to emphasize, although it would be perfectly permissible for the oil and gas companies to raise the price for the first sale of natural gas, subject to the limitations of the Natural Gas Policy Act.
I think it's 11A. I'm sorry, I have the jurisdictional statement. You're really right.
Let me emphasize the language I'm speaking about. In other words, although it would be perfectly permissible for the oil and gas companies to raise the price for the first sale of natural gas, subject to the limitations of the Natural Gas Policy Act, all that Act 79-434 requires is that the increase in severance tax mandated by that act be borne by the producer or severer of the oil or gas. Thus, the pass-through prohibition contained in Act No. 79-434 does not conflict with the Natural Gas Policy Act of 1978, and the trial court's finding to that effect is due to be reversed. Now, what they said is that under the Alabama law and a reading of the NGPA, it's perfectly permissible for the first seller of the natural gas to include in the maximum lawful price the increase in the tax, just so long as he doesn't tack it on as a tax. Now, I take strong exception with something that Mr. Arendall said. He said that the Natural Gas Policy Act requires clearly in its language that the tax be added to the maximum lawful price as a tax. Let's look at what the Act really says. I don't have the joint appendix cite to this. It's 15 U.S.C. 3320, paren A, paren 1. A price for the first sale of natural gas shall not be considered to exceed the maximum lawful price applicable to the first sale of such natural gas under this part if such first sale price exceeds the maximum lawful price to the extent necessary to recover, and then it says subdivision 1, state severance taxes attributable to the production of such natural gas and borne by the seller. If you look on, it also allows the recovery of the cost of transportation, the additional increased cost of production.
But Mr. Brecker, doesn't that mean that the only way the producer can get the increase under the federal statute is to identify it as a recovery of a severance tax? And isn't that the one thing the state law prohibits?
I don't think so, Justice Stevens. I think surely he can give an itemized billing, but he can't add a surcharge or surtax as the appellant.
If he's going to go over the ceiling by a certain percentage, doesn't he have to make it perfectly clear for federal purposes that the extra amount being charged is to recover the state severance tax?
I would think so.
And is that permitted under state law?
Yes, sir, I would think so.
Well, then what does the state law prohibit?
The state law simply prohibits billing the consumer when he gets the gasoline or the fuel oil or whatever it's used for, saying the price of this gasoline is $1.09 a gallon plus 3 cents increased severance
which
tax.
Which is put on to recover the severance tax. That's prohibited by state law.
That's what he must do
under the federal law to get the increase.
But the federal law does not prohibit, the federal law does not require that the tax be added to the maximum lawful price. It says it shall be included in the maximum lawful price.
But it does say that you can raise your price by the amount of a severance tax if you have separately billed or charged the
severance
tax.
That's correct. And I think Justice Stevens says when you send somebody that bill where you've increased your maximum lawful price, do you think it's okay for them to tell the buyer why the price is increased? That it is due, in this instance, to an increase in the state service tax. And I say, yes, I think it's permissible to tell the buyer that the increased maximum lawful price has been increased because of a 2% service tax in Alabama.
Well, let me give you two examples. Suppose there's a charge made of a quoted price of $1, and to that is added a 2% severance tax. So your bill is $1.02 per item. Now, is that permissible under Alabama law?
If you say the price is $1 plus 2% tax, as we go into a, can I draw an analogy quick?
Well, no, but perhaps you could just answer that and then explain.
Then I would say that you could not do it that way.
Supposing you have you bill the person $1.02 and say 2 cents of this is for...
You could do it that way.
But do you think you could recover... you think you could raise your price under the NGPA if you did it that way?
Yes, I think you could. And to answer one of Justice O'Connor's questions, what injury have they suffered if they're allowed to pass along the tax? How have they been harmed? They're allowed to pass along the tax, and I don't see what they're saying, how they've been injured.
What is the state interest in requiring the billing procedure to follow a precise form, one form rather than another? I can understand a state law that says you can't pass it on, but what is the purpose for a state law that says you can pass it on provided you do it in the following form?
In Alabama, we have certain rules of statutory construction that the Commissioner of Revenue has to follow, and even the Supreme Court follows these rules in Alabama, and that is that you don't try to find out the motives of why the legislature
did it. You don't really care whether there's a reason for it or not.
As long as it's not palpably arbitrary and erroneous.
Why isn't it palpably arbitrary to say you must follow this form rather than another?
I think the legislature has full discretion. I think the Supreme Court of the United States has said over and over again that legislatures have wide discretion in where they want to levy the tax and who they want the tax to fall on.
Even if you cannot identify a rational basis for doing it, for that requirement?
I think a rational basis could be identified. I assume
I'm asking you. What is the rational basis for saying you must bill in this particular way?
I assume that the legislature of Alabama decided that they did not want to be perceived as levying another consumer tax, but wanted the tax to be upon the producers.
And well, if that's the purpose, I would think it would violate the prohibition of the Alabama law to, however you showed the severance tax on your bill, if you put a footnote at the bottom and say, by the way, 2 cents of the above $1.02 charge is severance tax, I would think you're right in the teeth of the purpose of the Alabama law. Because you're then telling the consumer, don't blame the feds, blame the legislature.
Let's look at what the Alabama Supreme Court, some of the rules they were faced with when they saw this conflict. The rules in Alabama and the rules of the Supreme Court of the United States are that when a statute is before the court and there are two interpretations, one of which will require a holding that the statute is unconstitutional, and another interpretation that will save the statute, that the courts are duty-bound to adopt the interpretation that will uphold the constitutionality of the statute. So legislatures are presumed to have acted reasonably and not to have passed unconstitutional laws. The Supreme Court of Alabama, in answering Justice O'Connor's questions about did they specifically say that the producers could do this, they said, looking at both the laws, we think it's perfectly permissible to raise the maximum lawful price, and just so long as you don't pass it along as a consumer tax.
Well, that's where I have trouble, I guess, is the quotation you read from page 12 of the joint appendix, when he has that thus in there, to me that thus doesn't follow at all. And you're hung with it because that's what you have to defend.
That's the language the Supreme Court of Alabama used, and we assume, the commissioner has to assume that they meant what they said.
Mr. Breckinridge, does it come down to you suggest that Alabama says the tax can be, quote, passed on, end quote, without saying so?
No, Justice Marshall. I say what they say is that the maximum lawful price can be raised, but that the tax...
Can it be raised, the amount of the tax?
It can be raised, the statute says, and I believe the Alabama Supreme Court says, implicitly, that it can be raised an amount to recover the cost of their paying the tax. Now, one of the things about the NGPA is it specifically provides that the tax has to be borne by the seller.
If you question and you say, what was this 2 cent raise, you say, that was the amount of the tax. What else could you say?
That was the amount that was necessary to, this is the amount I'm allowed to recover from you for my paying the state of Alabama service tax.
But it's not a tax.
It's not a tax on you, no, sir. It's a tax on me, and I'm allowed to pass
it's not a passed-on tax.
No, sir. I'm allowed to recover my cost.
You want us to approve that?
Sir?
You want us to approve that?
Yes,
sir. Mr. Breckinridge, would it be fair to say that the Supreme Court of Alabama interpreted as narrowly as conceivable the anti-pass-on provision? The legislature said you can't pass it on directly or indirectly. And I suppose maybe you might have read that requirement as saying that the only way to absorb it is after you declare a dividend to the stockholders. You have to take the tax out of that dividend. But the Alabama Supreme Court came out at the other end of the spectrum and said that really all we're talking about is you can't add it to a quoted price.
I would agree with that, Justice Rehnquist. The appellants have also raised certain issues about the contract clause. And they have cited the Borrowers case as we cited the Borrowers case. And I think the Borrowers case, the Texas, the United States Supreme Court case, Borrowers v. Shepherd, is more in favor of the state of Alabama or the Commissioner of Revenue's interpretation than the appellant oil companies. It's almost black-letter law in America that parties to a private contract cannot limit a state's ability to levy taxes or to select upon whom those taxes are to fall. Clearly, two individuals or two corporations can't get together and say, as between us, we're going to bind the state of Alabama or any other state and say that they can't levy any additional increased taxes on us. And I would like to point out, and I'm sure the court realizes, that every tax of any kind, in some extent, affects a contract right. Every tax that I can think of, to some extent, affects somebody's contract. It's just inconceivable that the state's sovereign right to tax can be taken away by a contract between private corporations. There is an implicit, the commissioner submits that there's an implicit limitation on the right to contract that must recognize a sovereign right of a state to exercise its power of taxation. As Justice Holmes has said in the Borrowers case, or was quoted in the Borrowers case, one whose rights are subject to state restrictions cannot remove them from the power of the state by making a contract about them. I'd like to go back for a moment about the Natural Gas Policy Act and raise an issue that we raised in our briefs. And that is that the Alabama statute contains a severability clause. The Alabama statute we're talking about is over 4 pages long. And the one sentence we're talking about is simply that, one sentence. It's the position of the Commissioner of Revenue that should this court decide that the pass-through prohibition is preempted under the Supremacy Clause by the NGPA, that because the Act contains a severability clause which says that should any portion of this Act be deemed unconstitutional, the remainder of the Act shall stand, shall survive, that the court, at the very least, would have to send it back down to the State Supreme Court of Alabama to determine whether or not what effect the severability clause has. Now, it's a matter of record that less than 10 months later, the legislature of Alabama adopted the identical language of Act 79-434, and they left out one sentence, the pass-through prohibition, and they added one sentence that allowed unitization method of reporting. We think this is highly persuasive that the pass-through prohibition was not an essential part of the 79 Act so as to cause the whole Act to fall.
This assumes that you get by the other grounds would invalidate the 2-cent tax, the 2-cent increase.
I'm not clear, Justice White, on what other grounds you're referring to.
I mean the equal protection and the contract.
All right. If the court rules, for instance, that the pass-through prohibition...
The preemption ground that wouldn't question the validity of the 2-cent increase.
I think, but let's look at the contract clause. What the oil companies are saying is that because of the anti-pass-through prohibition, their contracts are invalidated because they can't pass along the tax.
Well, you see, the reason I said it, suppose we thought that the pass-through provision were invalid under the NGPA.
Yes.
Would we still have to pass on the equal protection and the contract clause issues?
I don't understand how you could pass on the contract clause. That's what I was trying to say here. If the anti-pass-through provision, if you strike it down, if this court strikes it down, it's out. Mm-hmm. Where is the contract clause question then? The contract clause also hinges on the anti-pass-through prohibition.
Well, how about the equal protection?
I can address that now.
Well, I know, but wouldn't we have to...
Wouldn't we have to address it? I don't think so. I could suggest
because
what would
if they're right on the equal protection, if that issue is properly here, and if they're right on it, it means the 2-cent exclusion of the royalty owner is unconstitutional.
I'll say why. I think what the court would do is if it decided to strike down the pass-through prohibition and send it back down to the Alabama Supreme Court, usually this prudent court waits until the state Supreme Court has ruled on that question before it will. The state Supreme Court may strike the whole statute down. It may not. But we'd never get to the equal protection clause. The equal protection argument is, if I may go over what the equal protection argument is right quick, they're saying because the Supreme Court of Alabama refused to accept their version of the legislative history, things they call legislative history, that they were denied equal protection in state court. That's all it is. It's got nothing to do with the language in the statute.
That's their due process argument. Their equal protection argument is the fact that there's an exemption for royalty for the non-working interest owners. That's their equal protection argument.
If the court decides to address...
Well, do we have to decide it?
Justice Stevens, I would sort of disagree with you because not only did they say due process, but they say we were denied equal protection because
maybe you're right about the label for that argument. But to talk about the royalty interest owner problem for a minute. How do you answer that one?
First of all,
let me ask you the substance. In the legislation 10 months later, did you change the statute in this respect?
With regard to the royalty owner exemption, no, sir.
No, that's still there.
Let me reiterate. There were only two changes in the statute 10 months later. One, the anti-pass-through prohibition was deleted, and a method of reporting on the unitization method was added.
How do you justify two producers, one has a 50% working interest and the other has a 75% working interest. They both say they pay the same tax. Is that right?
Yes, same rate of taxes.
Same rate and the same dollar amount if they produce the same amount. Does the exemption mean that the smaller working interest pays a higher rate on his actual earnings?
I don't know, sir. I don't think so.
I don't.
I don't see it that way. I think that a 50% working interest owner would still pay at the rate of 2% and a 75%.
He'd pay on 100% of production. He pay 2% on 100% of production, even though his economic interest is only 50%. Isn't that right? Isn't that their argument? Maybe I don't understand their argument.
I don't understand that at all. I don't understand what you're saying. Honest with you.
But do you understand they are making an equal protection argument based on the exemption for the royalty interest?
Because
the economic effect of the exemption is to produce distortions in the rates paid by those who actually produce the gas.
Well, with regard to that answer,
the only exemption is for royalty interest, isn't it?
Yes.
Is there a rather standard royalty rate in Alabama?
No, sir. The oil companies for lessees, the testimony in the volumes of record, go from anywhere from 1/8 to 1/16 to 1/32. It's just
so
whatever the market will bear.
So Justice Stevens has to be correct, doesn't he, that if the tax is paid by the working interest, then royalty interests are exempt, then this tax burdens some producers more than others.
As the income tax burdens people with a higher income than people who make less. A lot of the legislature has the discretion to set the rates of tax, and they can decide, they have the clear...
Well, again, what is the rational basis for charging one producer a higher rate simply because he has a different percentage interest in the lease?
I don't think a royalty owner is a producer under the increase. I disagree with that assertion right away.
Well, that's a matter of statutory construction.
That's correct.
But if you construe the statute your way, it does have the effect of charging different producers different rates for the same amount of gas being produced.
If you construe it my way, I say a royalty owner for the 2% increase is not a producer. So it would not...
No, but the producer, if the producer has a smallage percentage interest in the lease, and they all pay 2% on total production, the producer with the smaller percentage is paying a higher percentage on what he actually earns.
If they all pay 2% on their production and one producer produces more, is a larger producer than the other, I don't see how that's a denial of equal protection. The smaller producer could produce more. I could make $1 million and pay income tax on $1 million. I don't see where that's denial of equal protection. What we're doing here is that so long as you treat every member of the class or subclass the same, you're not denying them equal protection. If you treat royalty owners, all the royalty owners one way and all the producers another way, but so long as you treat them the same, you're not violating equal protection.
Mr. Brecken, do your opponents say that it based their equal protection argument on the discrimination among producers, or do they say that you may not exempt royalty owners?
They say both.
They say both.
Yes.
Did they raise both those arguments in the Supreme Court of Alabama?
I think they did.
Is this discussion of the Supreme Court of Alabama where they cite the state case of Hayden against Watson at page 9 of the appendix? The Supreme Court of Alabama seems to simply talk in terms of the power of the legislature to establish classification. Was that a response to a federal equal protection argument by
the... I think it was, Justice Rehnquist.
Well, aren't there a lot of severance taxes that just hit the working interests around the country and exempt?
Yes. One that comes to mind is
coal unheard tax. It's not unheard of to exempt royalty owners from severance tax liability.
That's correct. That comes readily to mind is in Alabama, the coal severance tax.
That may be true, but that doesn't answer the equal protection argument insofar as it's based on a discrimination among producers.
As I understand Justice Stevens' example, he says you seem to be treating smaller producers at a different rate than the larger producers.
No,
they're different. They're smaller producers, and you're not treating them different.
Two producers producing exactly the same amount of oil are going to pay different amounts of tax, or they're going to pay the same amount of tax, but they have a less economic interest in the oil that's produced.
I disagree because
so the tax is going to be more burdensome.
I disagree because they can't. Neither one of them can pass along the increase to the royalty owner. They're both going to bear 100% of the tax.
Well, that may be so. But if I'm delivering tax free to the royalty owner 50% and still paying $100,000 severance tax, and my competitor is delivering only 25%.
But the statute
tax free.
I think the courts is the statute does not say that at all. The statute says the increase in the severance tax will be borne by the producer and should not be passed along to the royalty owner. So that the fact that he's got the producer is going to pay 100% of the severance tax on the amount of oil and gas that he severs, and the fact that he's got a royalty owner, and one of his competitors does not have to share his proceeds with the royalty owner, does not mean that they're being denied equal protection.
Well, I just suggest to you that two producers in the positions that Justice Stevens posited to you will end up, one of them is going to end up with less money in his pocket than the other.
Not, I don't believe by paying the severance tax that will cause him to lose it. At any rate, he's going to pay the same rate. I believe that if I pay income taxes, I'm going to pay at a different rate than somebody else. And at the end of the year, I'll wind up with less money than someone else. But that doesn't mean that I'm being denied equal protection by the income tax law.
The irony here is that the smaller your working interest, the higher your tax, is the way.
The appellants, Exchange and Getty and Union, have raised up here, again, the question of whether the Alabama statute is a local law or a general law. We feel like the state of Alabama was the court of ultimate competence to answer that question. We feel like the commissioner feels like the Supreme Court of Alabama answered that question fully. Before I finish, I'd like to go back to the severability clause, though. If the court decides to agree with the appellants with regard to the preemption question and the anti-pass-through prohibition, it's the position of the Commissioner of Revenue that the case must be sent back down to Alabama to determine the effect of the state severability clause. And we'd also like to say that appellants Exxon and Gulf and Louisiana Land and Exploration have drawn the analogy that the royalty owner exemption and the anti-pass-through prohibition are the same, and they're not. The royalty owner exemption says that the producer is prohibited from passing the tax along to the royalty owner. It says that the royalty owner's interest is exempt from the tax, is what it says. The anti-pass-through prohibition says that the producer cannot pass the tax along to the consumer. The royalty owner is not the consumer of the gas. What he is he's a lessor usually or contributed in some manner investing in the drilling of the well. To say that the royalty owner is in the same position as the consumer is a gross distortion of the facts in the opinion of the Commissioner of Revenue.
Your time has expired, Breckenridge. Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...